You are Locked On Orioles, your daily podcast on the Baltimore Orioles, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles, your place for Orioles news and analysis from the clubhouse to the warehouse and beyond. As always, I'm your host, Justin McGuire. I'm a veteran baseball journalist. I spent 8 years as a senior editor at Sporting News. I'm a former Cy Young and Rookie of the Year voter, and I'm a lifelong Orioles fan. I'd also appreciate it if you would check out my other podcast. It's called Baseball by the Book. Guys, today we're joined once again by Dan Zimborski. He's a writer for Fangraphs. He previously worked for ESPN, and he's here to talk about an article he recently wrote for Fangraphs about the Baltimore Orioles. We'll get to that in just a second, but first a couple of things. I just want to remind everybody that I would really appreciate it if you would go to iTunes or Google Podcasts and subscribe to Locked On Orioles and leave a 5-star rating and a review if you haven't done so already. The subscriptions, the ratings, the reviews, all that stuff helps us increase our visibility and increase our audience. So if you're enjoying Locked On Orioles, please go ahead and do that if you get a chance. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the Locked On Network is now Locked On to College. This week launches the college channel for the Locked On Podcast Network. If you're a fan of Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee, Florida, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Baylor, Penn State, Oregon, or BYU, go to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts and follow for free. It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles. We are joined now again by Dan Zimborski. He works for Fangraphs now and contributes to ESPN. He was working full-time for ESPN last time we talked to him. But, Dan, you've moved on to Fangraphs since then, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. New, I mean, same kind of stuff, writing about baseball. Just new location.
Yeah, definitely. It's, Fangraphs does great stuff, so I've been happy to read your stuff there. The one thing I wasn't too happy to read this week, though, was an article you wrote for them, which was the reason I wasn't happy to read it was because of what it's about, not because of how it was written. It was a good article, but it's called Elegy for 18, Baltimore Orioles. And basically, it looks like what you're doing is as teams get eliminated from the playoff race, you'll sort of do a postmortem on their season and look ahead to what they need to do in the future, that sort of thing. And the Orioles, of course, were the first team eliminated, so they were the first team up, right?
Yeah, I do them as they eliminated. Some years ago on ESPN, we did a project called Kiss 'Em Goodbye, where we did kind of this thing where we talked about teams as they went out. It was kind of like, you know, like almost at a funeral, it's their final gasp, the final talking about the season. Obviously, as we get to some of the better teams, it'll be, you know, more positive simply because their 2018s were better, because having an article like this in August means that you were a pretty poor team for the season. But I mean, the Orioles season, the win-loss record doesn't really end on a high note, but the organization itself has a bit of a high note ending the season. So it's not all negative.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in just a second. But the first thing I wanted to ask you about, could you get into this a bit? And I find it kind of fascinating. You know this as well as anybody, and people listening to this podcast know we talked about it a lot before the season began, and it's something that gets talked about among Orioles fans on Twitter a lot and that sort of thing. And that's the idea that for several years under Buck Showalter, these various projection systems, including some of the ones that you work on, have sort of undervalued the Orioles. The Orioles ended up having better seasons than they were projected to have, and there was always a lot of question, why was that? What was Buck Showalter doing something particularly right? Was it the bullpen? You know, lots of questions, and of course a lot of Orioles fans kind of, you know, took some joy in the fact that they outperformed their expectations a lot of times. This year we saw the opposite happen. They were projected not to be a good team by any means, but they were projected, I think, your latest projections before opening day, you said, had them winning 77 games, which obviously is a below 500 team, not a particularly good team, but certainly not the disaster we've actually seen in real life. This team has way underperformed even their modest expectations. Just for I know this is kind of a hard question, but why do you think they underprojected so much? Why did this season turn so disastrous so quick?
Well, you look at a lot of the things that should have gone right that didn't, and because, you know, most teams have a mix of things that go right and things that go wrong, and it, you know, it tends to even out most of the time. In this case, the Orioles really didn't get upside really from anyone but Manny Machado this season. pretty much everybody performed at their mean projection or worse than their mean projection. They didn't have a lot of good news. They didn't even have one of those guys that, you know, gets 100 at bats and, you know, slugs 550 in a surprise. They got none of that. You have Chris Davis trying to, you know, have the worst season in history. Even Mark Trumbo's comeback isn't really that good. You have Adam Jones aging. Tim Beckham has had struggles. Really, Jonathan Scope for the most of the start of the season into kind of the he had a better year as we got towards the summer, but everybody pretty much underperformed. And of course, it's tricky to say the why, because sometimes things don't happen for a reason. It's just sad in a way.
Yeah, it is sad, of course. And I think as Orioles fans, we've gone through the stages of grief here, and I think most of us have come to acceptance at this point. Maybe it's August 22nd, and it seems like August 22nd is the date of your article, I should say. It's later than that as we record this, but it's August 22nd, and we're already having an elegy for the Orioles. So I think people have had a while to get used to the idea that this team is really bad. One of the things you talk about, though, in your article, which I think is interesting, and I tend to agree with to a certain extent, is this may have been, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you said something to the effect of, in some ways, this may have been the best thing to happen for the Orioles. Because, and the reason for that is, you know, just like addicts have to hit rock bottom before they seek help, the Orioles had to hit rock bottom for ownership and for the people making the decisions to say, this really is a problem. We need to rebuild. We can't just pretend that we're a few free agents away from contention. If they do win 77 games, maybe they can, you know, convince themselves of that. Oh, we could win 10 more games and be in the wild card hunt if we do this and that. They can't pretend that anymore, and they haven't pretended that anymore. So do you think it is fair to say that this maybe long-term was the best thing for the organization?
I totally agree. If you're not going to be competitive and you're a team that can't simply retool, because you look at the fundamental problems of the Orioles, some of the depth issues, the lack of minor league development that has come up through the system lately, the rotation was, of course, dreadful in 2017. And those weren't things you could fix quickly without spending a lot of money. And even spending a lot of money, it would have been hard to fix that. If the Orioles had signed the top four free agents in like the rankings this offseason, they'd still be a pretty terrible team. Just, you know, a terrible team with a $200 million payroll. I think that a lot of times for certain teams and certain organizations, you do have to hit rock bottom. I have a lot of complaints about Peter Angelos as an owner, but I've never questioned that he wanted to win. And sometimes being that close to the situation and always wanting to win can sometimes thwart your best intentions, say, because sometimes you do have to do a full rebuild. It's hard to do that on the fly. Competing and rebuilding at the same time can be done, but you have to be good at one or the other first. You can't just say, oh, we'll do everything. We'll win now and win later, when you don't have the tools in the organization to do either. So to actually have a new beginning, develop, there's no reason that the Orioles can't do what the Astros did. I mean, there's literally nothing that Houston did or the Cubs did or the White Sox are trying to do. There's nothing that the Orioles can't do in that case. And in fact, you can say it's even more important for the Orioles to do that, because they cannot compete with the Red Sox and Yankees when it comes to just spending on major league talent right now. It's not going to happen. They're not going to spend $200 million. So it's even more important to have a solid foundation of, you know, minor league development, up-to-date organizational thinking, and so on.
On that note, Dan, we haven't talked since the trade deadline, since the Orioles made these series of moves, starting with Manny Machado, including Zach Britton, Brad Brock, Kevin Gausman, Jonathan Scope, trading away a lot of their major league talent for prospects, or, you know, in some cases for some international signing money, but basically looking to the future, looking to start that rebuild in a way they hadn't in a long time. So, like I said, we haven't talked since then. So I just wanted to get your thoughts. What do you think in terms of how they approach? I know I can tell from talking to you and knowing how you think that you believe it was the right thing to do to make these trades at this point. What do you think about how they actually executed them, though, in terms of what they got back for them? Do you think they're going about it the right way at this point?
I think they have generally gone about it the right way. I know some people were disappointed with the return from Manny Machado, but the truth is that teams aren't going to give a king's ransom for 2 months of any player these days. I know people was like, well, why don't they get Alex Verdugo and Walker Buehler? It's like, no, that was never, ever going to happen. Teams are, you know, more analytically inclined these days, and they're not going to just go nuts over a single guy for 2 months. It's just not happening. And I do like that they got a mixture kind of upside guys, really at all positions. They didn't just say, let's only get pitchers, let's focus on hitters. They got pretty much any kind of gamble they could make, they're going for. And I like that approach rather than say what the Royals did by getting Brett Phillips for Mike Moustakas, because I don't think the Orioles should be looking at, you know, near major league talent that may have a higher floor but a lower ceiling. I think that early on in a rebuild, you're looking for those lottery tickets. You're looking for upside. And you take a guy like Yusnil Diaz or someone like Dylan Tate, who's had questions, but they do have upsides. And that's what I'm interested in, and that's what I think the Orioles have done. I think they did very well. I mean, there's no one there that stands out as an instant superstar. But again, from what they traded, that was probably not in the cards.
Right, and I think, again, we could talk about this, but if they'd wanted that kind of return, they needed to trade Manny Machado, say, a year ago or even longer ago or something like that. You're not going to get it for a couple of months. You're just not going to get that kind of return generally. And I think one of the things that I've talked to some people who follow the farm system closely, and a lot of what they say is, this was, you know, needed to just get the farm system back to just a basic, you know, base of players, right? Of the kind of prospects. There may not be a future superstar there, but they need just some players who are going to be major league players for them. And they didn't really have a lot of that, and they've really helped themselves in that regard.
Yeah, there's that's been the problem with the Orioles system. I mean, they had developed players. I mean, they still get credit for Manny Machado after all. But you're missing those players that you can call up that can really push your team forward. There's no real David Bote of the Orioles. And even the top teams like the Astros and Cubs that can afford things, they sometimes have to turn to these guys in system. Like the Orioles don't have someone like Max Stassi of the Astros, people you could just minor league depth that's interesting and may not have a high ceiling. I'm glad to see the steps they have. I mean, most of these players aren't going to be superstars. You look at like the Adam Jones trade. I mean, he was the player that worked out. None of the other players worked out to the same extent. I mean, you had Luke Scott when you look at those trades that happened. What was it, 2007 now?
Yeah, I'm something like that. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's been a long time. But that was from the Tejada trade, not from...
Right. And you know, Chris Tillman gave them a little bit over the
Tillman
years.
Tillman too.
And that's, like you said, you know, if some of these guys end up being major league contributors, that's what you're going for at this point. So I guess that brings up the next question of, you know, what's next? Now, obviously, they have a more than realistic chance of having the number one overall pick next year in the draft. It's going to be them or the Royals. I mean, it's amazing to me that this team, as bad as they are, and they're still not guaranteed the number one pick, because there's another team that's almost as bad. But so anyway, they'll get a high pick next year, either the one or two pick, and maybe that's their opportunity to get that future superstar to kind of lead the system.
Yeah, and of course, there's interesting players. I know some of the mocks had them getting Bobby Witt Jr. I don't know how I feel about, because I've reached that age where I'm seeing a lot of the players I remember growing up, their kids are in baseball now. I have mixed feelings about that. I still call Cody Bellinger Clay a lot. I still call Austin Romine Kevin Romine a lot. It's a symptom of, I guess, growing senescence.
Well, there's players, you know, like, you know, Mike Yastrzemski, for instance, is the grandson of Carl Yastrzemski, and I remember Carl Yastrzemski playing, so that's how old I am. There's grandkids of people in the major leagues and minor leagues now, so it gets even worse as you get older.
Yeah, well, does Ken Griffey Jr. have a kid that plays baseball? Because I'm trying to think, or he might be...
He has a kid who's a football player, I know.
Yeah, I didn't think... Yeah, that would make me feel really old, too, because I remember Ken Griffey Sr. at the end of his career.
Right, yeah. So it's, well, anyway, we're all getting old. But so I guess then one of the things you have in this article is kind of a look ahead, what's next. And as I talk about on this podcast all the time, one of the problems with the Orioles is that we don't know who's going to be making decisions in the offseason. We don't know if Dan Duquette's going to be around. We don't know if Buck Showalter's going to be around. They could both easily be gone. It's possible one of them is still here. What do you think in terms of, do you have any better indication now than you did a few months ago of who's actually making the decisions on this team and what they might be thinking going forward?
That of course, is the $100 million question. I still don't know how the organizational structure is going to pan out for the Orioles. And I think it's important, not so much, I wouldn't say streamlined probably isn't the best way for me to describe it, but you do want to have, you know, responsibilities that are definite. You don't want this overlapping group of people who aren't really working together. Literally nobody I know that's close with the team thinks that Duquette and Showalter ever really had a relationship of that type. And that's pretty contrary to what you see a lot of teams do. With the Indians, even the analytics department works very closely with Terry Francona. The same with the Astros. From top to bottom, the organization works together. They're all on the same page, working to the same goal in more or less the same way. But you don't really see that in Baltimore. And I think I don't know which people they're going to feel most comfortable with, but they need to have that kind of modern team. You look at the Yankees. And Joe Girardi wasn't a bad manager for the Yankees by any means, but he also was not always on the same page as Brian Cashman. So one of the reasons that they got fired Girardi, let's just say it, it's probably a little extreme for what they intended, but they wanted someone younger that they could work with, that Cashman and Boone can be on the same page with things. And that kind of communication is important because teams aren't run like on shoestring budgets anymore. They're not run at the seat of their pants where they just everyone makes decisions. These things are discussed in organization. All the people with input and things that knowledge that can help increase their understanding of a player. All the people with skin in the game work together for the same goal, let's just say.
One thing that came up during all these trades was, and I talked to some other guests about this, and everybody sort of seems to find it really interesting, I'll put it that way, is that during the trade process, Dan Duquette really became the face of the organization again. He was the guy making all the comments about the trades. He seemed to be the one making the decisions about the trades. He was talking about the Orioles wanting to get more in on international signings. And he was talking like a guy who was planning to be there for a while. Do you think it's possible Dan Duquette is back in this role? I think this is something we probably all assumed wasn't going to happen before the trade deadline. But now it appears maybe he's going to be back. What do you think?
I would be happy if he was back, and he also had some actual authority over some of these decisions in the organization. Because you know, you talk to people that cover the team on a day-to-day basis. Because you know, I'm a national guy, so I'm not in every clubhouse for 162 games a year like some of these guys. But Duquette, I believe, was always the one who was the most interested in a rebuild. There's always like a fun game among people who cover the Orioles, figuring out which transaction is which of the many cast members of the Game of Thrones front office that they have. Like Chris Davis, people believe that was ownership. Tillman's return, people think that's Brady Anderson. But the general consensus is that Duquette is the one who wanted to rebuild. And personally, I think probably Dan Duquette's the most capable decision maker in the organization. I know he gets a lot of the negative credit for some of the things the Orioles do, but being familiar with Duquette from his stints with the Expos and Red Sox, that he would be more, I mean, he was a good general manager, and that he would be behind a rebuild in that idea, it strikes true to me. So I would like to see them keep him, let him hire his guy at manager, let him hire his staff, give him authority to make these decisions, to make the Orioles a real rebuilding team that doesn't, you know, half-ass it going forward. So I have some fond feelings about Showalter, but I don't really think he's the guy to manage this Orioles team for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I don't think he's the guy you want around for a rebuild. And I had a conversation earlier this week on the podcast, and you know, whoever the next manager is, assuming that Buck Showalter is gone after this year, is likely to be a guy who maybe is only around for a few years as they are horrible, and then maybe they bring in somebody else new when they start winning again, which seems to be the pattern with a lot of these teams. So, you know, you don't necessarily want Buck Showalter in that role of being the guy who has to have multiple 100-loss seasons. In some ways, I don't think that's fair to him. and it's probably not the right decision in terms of the future of the organization as well. It may be time to give him his golden watch and thank him for his years of service and move on to somebody else.
Lots of managers are better in some situations than others. I think of Dusty Baker a few years ago with Washington, and I know, Baker obviously gets a lot of pretty just criticism from especially the numbers crowd, but I thought I really liked when the Nationals hired him simply because they were a veteran team that was established that didn't need to do anything fancy, just keep the team from killing each other, keep the veterans playing well, and squeeze the most out of them. And I thought Baker was wonderful for that role. But I don't think a Dusty Baker type would be wonderful at all for a rebuilding team like the Orioles. I think that probably it's too soon to really talk about names for a guy you'd like to see, especially with Showalter still employed. But I think the most important thing for the next manager isn't that he's a tactical genius or anything, but simply that he can work with Duquette, that he's brought in without any false pretenses, that he's like, hey, you're a caretaker guy. That's going to help do the next rebuild, kind of, like a specialist you come in, like when you need back surgery and you call the orthopedist. I think the important thing is that Duquette and the next manager, if it's Duquette, that's no guarantee, but if it's Duquette, that they're on the same page and they're working towards the goals in similar ways. And there's that, give and take, a relationship of trust.
Now, it seems like I can't get through a podcast episode without talking about Chris Davis. He's sort of the albatross hanging around the shoulders of this team at this point, and kind of just everything is sort of goes back to that contract in some ways. You do your Zips projection system in your article here, where you look at his next four seasons, which, of course, he's under contract for the next four seasons. The numbers are pretty ugly, and to be honest, they look a little optimistic to me in some ways.
Yeah, I described it as the most depressing projection ever that projected a 2-win improvement.
Right. I mean, it's like, if anything, like I think he's going to be even worse than these numbers, and these numbers are bad to begin with. So that begs the question, what do the Orioles do about this? Again, he's under contract for 4 years. As you said, he's completely untradeable. He's not even releasing him is not going to get you much, because nobody's likely to pick him up and even pay him that minimum salary and save you that salary relief. Do they just hang around with him for 4 years and just hope for the best? Or what happens with Chris Davis now?
See, I can't see them just releasing a player who they're paying for essentially the next 20 years. I think the best thing to do with him, and I did talk about it in my piece, is to let him be a role player, move him around. I'd give him some time at third base, just someone to fill in some spots and hope for the best, unless he decides that he wants to retire. Maybe they can come to some agreement on a buyout. It's kind of funny in a way, because the deferral money was such a good deal for the Orioles, because it was deferred at 0% interest, and you'd much rather spend, $40 million in the 2030s than spend it in the next couple of years. But it will serve as a reminder to the team and the reminder to the public, in the way the Bobby Bonilla buyout did, that Davis had a terrible contract. He was overpaid, it's almost in a way worse that they're getting that deferred money, simply because it adds to the historical story of the Davis contract.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, that Bobby Bonilla thing has taken on such a life of its own that people, I think his contract was even worse than it was, and because they're still paying him.
I mean, it was a buyout it was $6.5 million, I believe, that he was owed at the time. And they could have just paid him and been out with it. But it's kind of weird that it was kind of wrapped up with the whole Bernie Madoff thing, because one of the reasons that the Wilpons were willing to do that at such a high interest rate was because, they were getting those fake Madoff returns. So it's weird that the Bobby Bonilla story and the Bernie Madoff story have kind of have a little bit of overlap. The other favorite contract I have is Bruce Sutter, who the Braves are still paying now. And I believe they still pay him, I think, until 2021. And they owe him like $9 million that year, I think.
I mean, it's amazing. That Bruce Sutter signed with the Braves when I was in high school, and I'm 50 years old now. So that's even more amazing than the Mania one in some ways.
Yeah, and I mean, Sutter, didn't have one good season for the Braves. And I believe it was like 12% interest they gave him on the deferred money. So that was way worse than the Davis contract.
It's amazing. I think we're talking about Bruce Sutter still here in 2018. And it's, yeah. All right. So anyway, people who want to read this article we've been talking about, it's called Elegy for 18 Baltimore Orioles, and it's on Fangraphs, and definitely should check that out. It's a sobering read if you're an Orioles fan, but like you said, it does have some optimism at the end in terms of where they're headed for the future. So that's I think better than it would have been last year when things still seemed very uncertain about what their actual approach was going to be.
Yeah, I'm much happier with the Orioles as an organization right now than I would have been 365 days ago. I think that they are on a path, because that's the danger for a team that wins 70 to 80 games a year. It's very easy to fall into this trap where you're not really rebuilding, but you're not really contending either. And then you end up treading water. It's the trap that the Orioles were in for a long time after 1997. There were a few times during that period that the Orioles were actually a horrible team. There were some years in the 60s, but they were never, say, the worst team in baseball. And there was always that little bit of hope that it might have been better to deprive them of.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I say to people a lot of times is the Orioles, during that whole stretch of losing from 98 to 2011, they never lost 100 games at any point. They've never lost 100 games under Peter Angelos, which is kind of amazing when you think about how bad they've been, or at least the perception of how bad they've been. And it's because of that, like you said, they were always a team that had enough major league talent to avoid a completely disastrous season. And then this year they're finally having that disastrous season. And like we said earlier, maybe it's the best thing for them. Well, Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Always fun. Thanks for having me again.
And that's going to do it for another edition of Locked On Orioles. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.